This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I met Nikola Tesla in a diner in New York. He was eating cotton candy in the dark. I sat down at his table and I asked him for a light. When his eyes met mine, I thought I felt a spark.
That's Boston's own Amanda Palmer singing her newest song, Nikola Tesla, an offbeat love song to the father of alternating current electric power. The lyrics were written by Palmer's husband, science fiction writer Neil Gaiman.
Ben Folds is on the drums and Damian Kulash of the band OK Go is on bass. The song was written and recorded in a single session earlier this week in an Alston recording studio. And if that weren't impressive enough, the supergroup also wrote and recorded five other tunes in the same night.
Because we don't know where you are, we're putting out the song. Because we think that you might hear and know.
The idea was to compose, record, and release eight songs in 8 hours. It turned out to be 6 and 12, but really, come on, who's counting? The effort was part of the Rethink Music Conference at the Berklee College of Music, and in today's talker, we're doing just that, rethinking music and the music business for artists and entrepreneurs. So let's start with a still no doubt sleepy Amanda Palmer. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's really great to have you back on the show. And now, actually, that you've had a couple days to reflect on that marathon recording session, what do you think of the albums you guys made?
I'm really, really proud of it. But it's also hard as a musician. It's hard to release something that's so totally imperfect. But I've also, I think it's one of those things, since, you know, me and Ben and Damian and Neil are all at places in our careers where we've put out so many things, I think it's actually really fun to put out something so imperfect, especially when, like, given the context that we made it in just 12 hours.
Well, actually, given
I'm really happy with it.
Given that context, Amanda, I mean, and you know, since this has been such a sort of transparent process from the start, and the whole thing was streamed on the web, and people could watch as you guys were hashing out the songs and arguing over how to match up the music with it, I'm wondering, would you take that to the next level and maybe, say, open it up for feedback from fans and maybe go back and re-record it?
You know, we discussed doing that because, you know, there were moments in listening back to the mixes where I was like, oh, if we had just had an extra half hour, we could have gotten that perfect. And if we had just had the time to put in that one vocal harmony that we had been talking about, but we just didn't have time. And what we decided was we were just going to leave it. You know, maybe I might win the battle way down the road if the band reunites and does another project like this. And we can have the, I keep joking that since it's such a, like, new media project and it's just digital, I keep joking that we're going to put out a 12 CD box set in a few years. It'll come, you know, it'll cost hundreds of dollars and come in a big, big plastic coffin and be this useless thing that
on. Well, fans obviously don't think that the concept, at least, is useless because, I mean, they were really involved in the creative process. You were talking about the new media aspect of this. So can you tell us how fans had direct involvement during that marathon session?
Well, the fans directly inspired the subjects of the song. We started at the very first thing we did right before we went live on the webcast and started the whole process. Was Neil sat down at his Twitter feed and said, we're coming to you guys for song titles and inspiration. And he started asking questions, but, like, really good questions to the Twitter feed, like, name an interesting famous person and name your most memorable kiss and tell me ways that love goes wrong. And since his Twitter feed and our collective Twitter feeds are filled with really cool, many artistic, creative people. We had thousands of people tweeting and ideas. And we just sort of all, like, you know, looked at them all really quick. We picked things that quickly inspired us. Neil went off to his computer and started writing. We all sort of started writing little songs. And then we broke off into groups and pairs and just, you know, it was a very first thought, best thought process. We didn't stop to deliberate about anything. The minute someone had a melody idea, we just sat down as a band and would play it. And, mm-hmm. And we did the vocals separately. But, you know, we didn't go back to fix anything. If a vocal was with the C-plus vocal, we kept it. If it was totally awful, we would redo it, but the clock was ticking, so we really didn't have any time to fix things.
Well, Amanda, let me ask you, or actually let's hear a little bit of this, because one of the people who were watching you on the Twitterverse suggested to Neil Gaiman, your husband, that he write a song about a squirrel committing suicide. And apparently that caught your attention enough that you actually did it. So let's listen to what Neil and Ben Folds came up with. We've got the Twitterverse and the creative talents of Amanda Palmer, Ben Folds, and Neil Gaiman to thank for that song. But Amanda Palmer, let me ask you, the Rethink Conference is really all about ways of, like, trying to find ways to resuscitate the music industry. A lot of, you know, the money's just been sucked out of it over the past several years by illegal downloading. So what was it that you and the band were trying to say about, you know, the future of the industry by making this whole project take, you know, 24 hours, having it be totally public from the start, having input from fans, and being a completely new media enterprise?
Well, I think the way you need to look at it is that, you know, I initially got invited to speak at the conference because I knew these guys and I was in Boston. And I asked if I could rope some friends in, and I said, you know, you really should get Damien Kulas from OK Go. He's doing such amazing things on YouTube, and you should really get Ben because, you know, he's totally, totally wired in and interacts with his fans. And what we were originally going to do is the four of us were just going to sit on a panel, you know, and talk for an hour between 11 and 12 in the morning about what we're doing on the net. And it's so depressing. Like, it seems so depressing that you would put these four artists together and just sit them at a table in front of a couple hundred people. And
yeah, it seems really passive, too.
Well, and such a waste of a cool bunch of people in the same place at the same time. And Ben and I sort of were on the same page about that. And I said, hey, we've got to do something more interesting than just sit there and talk. And Ben said, well, what if we recorded a really fast record the night before? And I said, that's it. That's perfect. Let's just do it. And, you know, I don't think we're trying to preach anything about the music industry. I think the whole thing, and the thing that most musicians have already known, but I think people in whatever you want to call the industry are learning, is that it's not like there's some magic bullet and some way forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reason these four artists got together to do this is that we really, really like to have fun. We wanted to take advantage of the fact that, you know, we were going to be in the same place at the same time, and that given the technology right now, you can crank out a record. You know, I mean, you could crank out a record this fast in 1966, but you couldn't get it to your fans that night.
Right. Amanda, there's a bunch of other people who I want to welcome into this conversation. But before I do, I just got to ask you, how many downloads have you had? I mean, have you made any money off the record? Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all
about. Thousands of downloads.
Thousands? I'm sorry, thousands, did you say?
I mean, thousands, probably tens of thousands at this point. The thing we decided to do is, you know, the money would have been split four ways if we'd made anything, and we decided the best thing to do would be to actually give the first wave of money to a charity. So it's going to a Berkeley-run charity that educates young kids in music. And in the first day, I think we made over $13,000 in donations.
Oh, wow.
And we gave it a dollar minimum. We gave the download a $1 minimum just to get people in the door, because if you make something for free, I think people would have been a little more reluctant to donate to the charity. But you get someone in there actually typing in their credit card for a dollar, and they're probably going to give a little bit more.
All right, Amanda Palmer, stand by. I mean, you were invited to the Rethink Conference because, as we're hearing, you're regarded as a real pioneer in the new music industry. You're one of those, like, very talented artist entrepreneurs. But listeners, I've got to ask you, is that the future of the music industry, kind of the Amanda Palmer model? And musicians, what are you doing to make it in the music business today? And listeners, everyone who loves music, how do you listen and where do you buy it, if you buy it at all? Where do you get your music? With recording labels and mass marketing kind of dying, is the future in the cloud and the crowd? But how can musicians make music and money at the same time that way? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, this issue of monetizing creativity, it was a big part of the Rethink conference, and Berkeley and the Harvard Business School co-sponsored a music business model competition as part of that conference. Top prize, $50,000. And we have the three finalists of the music business model competition with us now. I should say the winner was announced last night, but I'm going to wait a bit before I tell you who that was. First, we want to have each of the three finalists give us their elevator pitch, essentially, for their business model. And we'll have Amanda Palmer sort of chime in and with each one and say if it's useful from the artist perspective. So we're going to start with, we were going to start with Ian Kwan. He's co-founder of Fanatic FM. But Ian is unfortunately on a flight back home to Korea. So he sent his vice president for business development. He's Shinbo Wan. He's with us here in the studio. Hi there, Shinbo.
Hi.
So
thanks for having me.
Your elevator pitch for Fanatic FM.
Okay, well, Fanatic FM is a new platform that we're creating to allow musicians to start directly monetizing their streamed plays, not downloads. And we thought we could create a new relationship between musicians and brands in a way that's more direct than advertising. So we introduced a concept of sponsorship where companies can directly sponsor a certain musician and allow their listeners to listen for the music free while allowing the musicians to monetize directly.
Okay,
from those streams.
Okay, so help me understand. I'm putting on my VC hat or my angel investor hat now, and I don't quite understand how that's getting monetized for artists or even you as the platform.
Right, so companies, you know, when they advertise on streaming sites like Pandora and all the other models out there, they're basically targeting traffic, and they have no idea who the listeners really are, and they have no one-on-one connection with the musician or the music that's actually being played at that moment. But by having a direct sponsorship relationship with a musician, they're ensuring that whatever advertising fund that they create goes directly to the musicians that they choose, and their fans, by listening to the music, will generate a revenue stream from the sponsors directly to the musicians through our platform.
And the platform takes a 30% cut, something like that?
Yeah.
Okay. So, Amanda, as an artist, do you like the idea of your album being sponsored by a company of some kind, or the stream of the album at least?
I think that's always a really personal question for artists. And, you know, it's infinitely complicated. You know, in my days with the Dresden Dolls, we were always confronted with whether to, you know, use sponsorship directly or not. And sometimes we would be faced with situations where sponsorship, you know, was thrust upon us. We would show up at a venue and there would be a gigantic Sky Vodka sign behind the band. And we would kind of, you know, say, well, is there any way we could have this not here? And it would be, you know, the club had made a deal. So
it wasn't even your choice at that. Yeah. This might give you a bit of choice in that case.
Sure. I mean, I think for artists who aren't as concerned with protecting their fundamental cred and integrity, especially in the early days of their career, I think it's important not to wave yourself around with a big corporate sponsor. Then again, if you can find a product that you really do believe in and you use, Brian and I always used to seriously say we would take a sponsorship from Dr. Bronner's soap in a second. But they didn't sponsor that.
Okay, Amanda, hang in.
It's different. It's different getting sponsored by something like that and, you know, Marlboro cigarettes.
Well, hang in there for just a second, because that was our first elevator pitch. We've got two more business models here that we're going to want you to chime in on. So let's move on to Max Wessel. He's founder and CEO of Nuevo Stage, and also he is a student at Harvard Business School. Hi there, Max.
Hi, how are you doing today?
All right, I'm on the first floor. You got until the third floor to pitch me.
Fair. Nuevo Stage is the first booking platform that guarantees new and amateur artists stage space if they can prove they have fans. What we do is we allow venues to list nights that they currently aren't using their stages totally vacant. Then we let bands list potential shows. send those potential shows out to their fan base. Fans agree. One at a time, they offer their credit card to buy a ticket, but no one gets charged. Once enough fans agree, kind of like the Kickstarter model for crowdfunding, once enough fans agree to buy tickets, the show actually gets booked, the artist gets the contract, and the fans get their tickets.
So it's like Groupon meets Kickstarter meets the music industry?
Yeah.
Priceline.
Meets Priceline. Amanda, what are your thoughts on that one?
My thoughts are, it's a fantastic concept. As a touring musician, I think it presents a lot of difficulties because when you route tours, you need an absolute guarantee of how your schedule is going to work, and there's not a whole lot of room for risk. But I think for local bands who can hold that Saturday night if the offer comes through, and then drive out to Worcester or drive up to Maine or take that gig, it might actually be a really fantastic model. If it's not going to work for a gigantic act who has to book 50 gigs and mm-hmm. hire a crew and do a whole lot of scheduling around it, I think it's just going to get too dicey.
Okay, so our final music business model comes from Elliot Hunt. He's president of Boston-based Big Life Labs. He's joining us via Skype today. Elliot, same with you. I'm on the first floor. You got two floors to sell me your idea.
Excellent. Thank you so much for having me. Big Life Music is an online service that lets musicians use their computers as a stage where they can perform live for a worldwide online audience. And we're setting this experience in the context of a fun but competitive social game. So that's my real strict elevator pitch. The basic concept behind this is that musicians can do pretty much anything online these days except one key thing, and that's play live. And it just seems like such a wasted opportunity that the distribution power of the web isn't being tapped to allow musicians to actually showcase their talents live and get immediate feedback. So if you can imagine a live gamified, and I hate to use that word, but gamified version of YouTube, that can give you a real quick idea of what we're up to.
Okay, so Amanda, that might take care of the problem about having to tour all the time. You could just do it online.
Except I think there's a fundamental problem there's definitely cool things you can do with reaching an audience as a live performer through the web, but I'm always trying to remind musicians and audiences that there is no and never can be a replacement for being in a crappy bar where the floor is covered with sticky beer and getting sweated on by your fellow fans.
If I can jump in for one,
you can't recreate that with an avatar.
Oh, Elliot, you're gonna have to hold on there, and because okay. I know you want to keep selling us your idea, but I'll come back to you in a second because I do want to let listeners know who actually won the business model competition. So just to round us up again, we had Fanatic FM, that's Shinbo Wan, he was representing for that. Big Life Labs from Elliot Hunt and Nuevo Stage from Max Wessel. And the winner in the music business model competition was Nuevo Stage, and the idea of sort of crowdsourcing tickets to get local venues set up so that bands could go and perform there. Max, what did the judges tell you about why they chose your model as the winner?
So we had lots of conversations afterwards with the judges. And really what it came down to, at least from what we gathered, was the fact that we built a platform that really delivers and solves a problem. As Amanda said, we designed our product specifically for the local band, the amateur emerging artist that is struggling day and night to get a gig. And we eliminated the friction in the system for them. And the judges saw that our product actually fulfilled this product, and fix this problem. And while there are some huge roadblocks in terms of developing national scale, et cetera, we think that if we're able to really serve the artist properly, it's going to be a product that we'll be able to roll out.
And this was a big deal in part because live performances are becoming more and more important in terms of how musicians get their music out there and how they can get some return on their effort and creativity.
Absolutely.
Just out of curiosity, are you beta launching Nuevo Stage anywhere?
So we are beta launching Nuevo Stage in Boston.
When?
So the goal is to launch at a larger scale with this upcoming fall semester, so we can get student bands at Berkeley, et cetera, really booking around town very efficiently.
Okay, so listeners, what do you think of all or any of the ideas you've heard about the future of making money in the music industry that you've heard today on Radio Boston? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got a lot of commentary on our Facebook site about this. Abby Barrett wrote to us a little earlier today, and she was like, flat out, I don't know too many local musicians who don't also have a day job. So the reality there, a reality check from Abby Barrett. But let's go to Jordan, who's calling from Smithfield, Rhode Island. You're on the air, Jordan.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem. What's your thought?
My thoughts are, well, first I wanted to say how I get my music. It may not be the most up-and-up means. I go to YouTube a lot of times and just kind of search for the song that I have stuck in my head or that I want to hear or that someone told me was cool. And a lot of times there's a video, oftentimes from an official page, that will play. I don't know how that works out with royalties to the artist, but I listen to almost all my music that way or via Pandora on my phone. So,
Jordan, thank you so much for your call. Amanda Palmer, and then gentlemen also, please feel free to chime in at any time. But Amanda, I just want to start with you. I mean, Jordan sort of hints to us at the many channels that musicians have these days, YouTube, Pandora to a certain extent, their own websites. How do you as an artist, you know, manage getting your music out on so many different venues?
Well, I think one of the important things to point out is that you as the artist don't have to, I mean, your fans do a lot of proliferating for you. I'm going to point out that, you know, even just this record that we made on Monday has gotten more traffic on YouTube because of a fan video that somebody made the next day. We put a call out for people to also do really quick and dirty fan videos. And one of them is proving really popular. It's, you know, someone just made it with their iPad and a bunch of origami in their backyard. And it's really beautiful and really cool. And, you know, there's no one who's really going to be making money off of those plays on YouTube. But as far as I've always been concerned, as long as your music is proliferating out there, you shouldn't really try so hard to manage, because you never manage it, because you just don't know where it's going to land.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know who's going to see that video clip and then maybe Google and wander over to the band camp and actually download the music, or go to a Ben Folds show and buy a shirt. Or,
right.
You know, so you really kind of have to look at it as an unmanageable wild west of content out there. And, you know, you can steer your fans to certain places on the web that'll benefit you, but I think trying to put anything else on lockdown is a complete waste of time.
Let's take another call here. Angela's calling from Westford. You're on the air, Angela.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on, you had asked earlier where we selected our music, and I say I'm a little bit old-fashioned. I pull it from iTunes. I get referrals from my daughter. And I love this idea of Nuevo. I think that would be fantastic. But one of the things that's concerning to me, and I wonder what people think about this, is as we come into tools that help us collapse music in certain genres and recommend music in certain genres, I feel like that music selection gets very, very narrow for listeners. And I wonder what people think about what will happen and how we keep selections expanding with all these tools that do consolidation and crowdsourcing.
Mm. Angela, thank you so much for your call. And I should also take this opportunity to say that I pulled up a number in terms of iTunes revenue paid back to record labels. I think they've hit a cumulative $12 billion mark. So iTunes, you know, I love how Angela called it old-fashioned, but it's still very, very present. Elliot Hunt, I'm at Big Life Labs. What do you make of what Angela says about being sucked into basically what is an echo chamber of your own taste? And how do you avoid that?
That's a good question. I think if I had the perfect answer for it, I would probably be a very very happy person. I don't know. I mean, that's a great question. I think we're all struggling to try and figure that out. And, you know, one of the ideas that's really intriguing to me that's sort of surfaced through this whole Rethink conference and hearing Amanda working on her project is kind of the idea of getting fans interacting with musicians to help kind of drive where the music is heading. I mean, yeah, it's moving in a more personalized direction where we're trying to get more personalized experiences centered around music. But I think there's something really to be valued in the collaboration between artists and fans. So to me, like, there's the future kind of points in that direction just a bit, of really opening up collaboration between musical fans, not just fans who passively, you know, listen to music, but ones who actively make music themselves and find a way to bridge that gap.
Shinbo Wan, your thoughts on that?
No, I actually absolutely agree with what Aaliyah just said. And, you know, like the rise of social media as a very viable distribution channel, I think this is definitely an area that musicians should tap into. And this is something that could really cater to a wide variety of listeners' tastes. So, you know, sifting through it and finding the right one for you may be a little work, but, I mean, if you do find it, you will definitely be able to enjoy the exact kind of music that you really love.
Max Wessel, with Nuevo Stage, you're a Harvard Business School student, and actually this is also a question that applies to everyone here. It sounds like you guys are all really positive that there is still a great deal of money away from the conventional record label, promoter, A&R kind of model to be made in music.
Absolutely. I think, you know, at the end of the day, you always have to step back and ask the very basic questions. And in this case, when everyone's yelling that the sky is falling, we're not going to stop listening to music. People love music. It's a fundamental part of our daily existence. And so, yes, things are going to change. Digital distribution is changing. Copyright law is changing. But we're all going to, for our business, people are still going to go see live music because it's an experience. Mm-hmm. Artists are going to be able to monetize themselves that way. People are still going to buy records. It's not going to be the same as it was during the CD era, but it'll still be there. So I think there's great opportunity. And I personally think that not enough people are looking right now creatively as to how to shape the industry moving forward.
Hey, Amanda Palmer, so I'm going to throw the last question to you, because it sounds like in the new evolution of the music industry, basically a lot of the reward and risk is being shifted to the musician or the bands, meaning they've kind of got to do a little bit of everything. I was looking at David Cusack, who's the vice president at Berkeley. He's got a blog about the future of the music industry. And he says in the new artist model, the artist has to create a business around him or herself, own the masters, secure the sponsors, purchase the services, connect directly with fans, interactively market, create multiple revenue streams, and control the career. And oh, by the way, make music at the same time. You've obviously been able to do it really, really well, but can everybody? I mean, that seems like a really tough suite of things for most musicians to have to do.
Yeah, it is really difficult. And I think, you know, the thing that I keep reiterating to people is that since I love being social and I really, really like sharing my life and I'm enjoying all of these new tools and, you know, this playground seems like it was actually perfectly tailored to me and my kind of impulsive, crazy way of making music and touring, I'm just really lucky that I'm doing what I'm doing right now. You know, I would have I don't know what I would have done in 1986 and 1996 if a major label had just shelved my record. I wouldn't have had the tools to go directly to my fans. Now, there are a lot of musicians and artists out there who don't feel that way, who don't love blogging, who don't want a Twitter. They really just prefer to write songs and put them out to the public. And they're just, I think, in this particular era of music, they're just the unlucky ones. They're going to have to be more creative about finding a way out.
Amanda Palmer, maybe you are showing them the way. That is Amanda Palmer. She's a musician and was also once with the Dresden Dolls. Thank you so much for being with us again on Radio Boston, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
We were also joined today by Max Wessel, founder and CEO of Nuevo Stage. Thank you so much, Max.
Thank you.
Elliot Hunt, he is the president of Big Life Labs. Thank you, Elliot.
Thank you so much.
And Shinbo Wan, Vice President of Development for Fanatic FM. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
There's more in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.